That's Eddie Harris, who introduced the electrified saxophone to the world of music with Listen Here. That's from his 1967 album, The Electrifying Eddie Harris. Harris, born and raised in Chicago, was also excellent at piano and jazz organ. He did much of the music for The Bill Cosby Show. Bone cancer, unfortunately, claimed him in 1996 at the age of 62. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, July the 29th, and we're talking about strong-arming justice, the NYPD, chokeholds, and the law. In the aftermath of the July 17th death of 46-year-old Eric Garner, the Staten Island, New York man who died after an aggressive arrest by police in which an illegal chokehold was used to subdue him, Mayor Bill de Blasio and Police Commissioner William Bratton are promising reforms of police procedure and promising to retrain all of the city's 35,000 police officers. But Garner's death is not the first to bring the continued use of chokeholds by police, outlawed since 1993, to light. Some 1,022 chokehold complaints were filed with the city's Civilian Complaint Review Board between 2009 and 2013. It investigated 462 of them, the CCRB said, but substantiated only 9 of those complaints. Since Garner's death, chokehold allegations have been made by at least 3 other individuals. The CCRB's statistics highlight a long-standing problem: the prevalence of the outlawed maneuver and the rarity of police officers using it, being caught and punished. This because there are many legal loopholes that favor police officers, our guest today says, and our guest is attorney at law, Alton H. Maddox, Jr., and he is again back at the courtroom, as he had announced here some time ago on Lead Stories, after the an illegal maneuver by the state. Alton Maddox has deep roots in political activism and advocacy, and he has been the people's self-appointed attorney general for more than 4 decades, litigating almost always pro bono some of the most contentious cases involving official and prosecutorial and police misconduct. His spectacular courtroom victories over formidable prosecutors and law enforcement agencies have set many legal precedents, but they also have made him a target for precedent-setting retribution. For refusing to violate attorney-client privilege in the Tawana Brawley case by turning over all of his files to the state, Maddox, without any formal charges against him, was barred from the practice of law in 1990, not by a court of law or by a lawyer's disciplinary committee, but by a highly irregular act of the New York State Legislature, the only attorney in the history of the United States to have been barred from the practice of law by legislative fiat. It was in Lead Stories, as I said, that he announced his return to the courtroom, and he's here with us to discuss some of the legal aspects and troubling legal aspects in the current case. Thanks, Alton, for being with us today.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Eutrice, and the wonderful introduction.
Thank you. Well, let's start with one of the questions. I would really like to know what your thoughts are about it, and that is, since this case, we have seen, of course, the Reverend Al Sharpton take the lead on this case in terms of the public perception that he is the go-to person when such issues arise. The community looks to him to play a major role in ameliorating things and in securing some measure of justice. And I found it interesting that the attorney who appears to be handling the case is one Sanford Rubinstein, who is an attorney who has been an attorney, personal attorney of Reverend Sharpton himself. This raises some questions in my mind as to whether this is a troubling thing. In many of the cases that Reverend Sharpton has been involved in, we have seen the same attorney and his office play the lead role in litigating the case. And of course, there had been major awards given on the conviction of the determination of civil liability by police departments. How do you read that? Does it trouble you?
Well, you know, Reverend Sharpton has elevated ambulance chasing to new unbelievable levels. And ambulance chasing itself is very disturbing because an ambulance chaser elevates money over justice. And in these cases, it is hush money. So it is a tainted situation when a lawyer is more interested in his pocketbook than in justice itself. So it is extremely troubling that Reverend Sharpton has been able to benefit from the Fourth Estate and wealthy benefactors putting him in a position where he essentially controlled the airwaves, and this is in violation of the Federal Communications Commission, because the airwaves belong to the public, except when it comes to blacks, and Reverend Sharpton is in charge of those airwaves, and he can direct or misdirect what moves should be made. And so you have a combination of him on one hand tainting the judicial process by conspiring with ambulance chasers to take a cut of the bounty, which is illegal. And on the other hand, you have him positioned to control the airwaves like air controller controlled flights. And so that is also equally troubling because if he wants to bring about a mid-air collision or a turbulent flight through a storm or whatever he directs, this is permissible. And so all of this is totally contrary to law and something that, you know, I've been trying to fight on many levels, especially in terms of censorship. But I don't seem to be able to get too many supporters because it seems though most people don't realize the real damage that is really being done to our community and the harm that it is causing to individual families who lose family members and are not entitled to justice.
And but so, surely this family is entitled to legal representation. Why would it be unseemly or troublesome to have an attorney who is also personally affiliated with Reverend Sharpton handle the case?
Well, because first of all, it's a violation of the attorney's oath. I mean, you know, the reality of it is lawyers are supposed to seek justice first. And when you collaborate with somebody who only has an interest in his pocketbook and not justice, then you have violated your own attorney's oath. And therefore, the harm spreads throughout the community. And that's what we are witnessing now at a time when law enforcement officials and rogue cops can give a wink every time they see Reverend Sharpton in place. Because they know that it is going nowhere. And, you know, the only thing our community had to look at is Reverend Sharpton's record. You know, you had the Abner Luima case where Abner Luima was sodomized by law enforcement officials, and he got a reward there. the police officer did go to jail, but had nothing to do with Reverend Sharpton. Our people must realize that there's a shoot-to-kill policy in New York, and it is beneficial for the city to have a dead body than to have a body in pain and suffering, because under tort law, a person under pain and suffering is going to get a substantial reward, whereas a person who is dead may end up getting nothing because of the way that the wrongful death statutes are worded in this state. And so, therefore, Abner Lehman did receive a substantial sum of money, and the police officer had to go to jail to serve notice on other cops that the best thing to do is to choke somebody to death or put a gun to their head or whatever the case may be, but the end result should be death, where it is not as costly to New York City.
I want to come to a very interesting parallel here. We seem to have two parallel systems, one within the New York Police Department, and that is via administrative judges and administrative adjudication of a case, as opposed to the regular criminal justice system. Now, where this case is being reviewed, presumably within that context of the internal review of the New York Police Department first, and therefore the question is, who has precedence here? Which system has precedence? The internal department, the internal affairs, or the administrative judge and review system within the police department, or the criminal justice system?
Well, what is really troubling here that exceeds the question that you raise is the fact that the governor of the state has control of the intermediate appellate courts, and there are four intermediate appellate courts in New York State. And so he appoints those judges, and as happened with Pataki, you had a black judge that the police officers were afraid of, and so they had Pataki to actually send a message to the intermediate appellate court. They should grant a change of venue and send this case to Albany. And so and they did, and this was the case of Abdul Diallo, who was shot at 41 times and died, certainly couldn't survive that kind of onslaught. And the jury acquitted the police officers. So that's one area. Then the other area were the bench trials, which it seems like black selected officials have no input into how these cases are being orchestrated. And so you can now also do judge shopping on a lower level, where you decide that, you want a particular judge who has a good ear for law enforcement officials and a greasy hand to take control of the case. And so it's the whole mechanism here, a whole system that really has to be analyzed and really attacked. And, this has come in the area where black people have to have also a political voice in order to bring some certainty to this area. And that means that you have to find some competent people who understand how to run a political party. And so, we're sort of lacking in that area because the political education has never been there. And we have only served as political pawns to these political parties. So we have never been really involved in the political mechanisms of the Democratic Party or even the Republican Party.
Well, already very early on in the case, I talked about this last week, about the 48-hour rule. These officers implicated in this fatal arrest of Eric Garner, that they invoked their so-called, these are work rights as per their contract with the city, the 48-hour rule, which in effect I argued is a temporary immunity from prosecution, because with the 48-hour rule, they're not allowed, or they can legally defy being questioned or being investigated by any authority. They don't have to answer to anybody for 48 hours or two working days, whichever works to their advantage. So with the 48-hour rule, how does that factor into the preliminary case, making of a case against a police officer or police officers who, in this particular situation, for example, are directly implicated, not just by eyewitnesses, but by documented video of their actions at the scene?
Well, what the 48-hour rule does is that it weakens the ability to impeach a police officer, and therefore the police officer appears to be more credible than he actually is, because he is now operating on a set of facts that would have been unknown to him, or an assortment of facts that would have been unknown to him had he immediately responded to questions. So this is a real benefit to police officers, to get some preliminary understanding of the various factors, what the medical examiner might be saying is important, what EMT personnel might be saying is important, what the eyewitnesses to the incident are saying might be important. And so now you can pretty much fabricate a tale that is consistent with what is being reported, and not necessarily reflective of what you actually did.
Now, I talked in the introduction about the Civilian Complaint Review Board having more than 1,000 complaints filed with it between the year 2009 and 2013. So it is a kind of contradiction, is it not, to say in the aftermath of Garner's death that they're now trying to put in place those systems to retrain police officers, when in fact, by their own admission, the city was aware, when you have more than 1,022 complaints about one thing, and that is a chokehold being applied to citizens, civilians, and this is now after the chokehold supposedly was outlawed in 1993, right there you have a problem. They've known about this problem and have monitored it since 2009 at the very least. So when the city now says, well, we are going to conduct training, they've said this stuff before, isn't the question, how is it that this rise in the number of cases specifically about chokeholds was systematically ignored?
Well, the thing that's very disturbing about these chokeholds is particularly as it relates first to a lack of response in the Garner's case to medical assistance, because this is an area that is so clearly in violation of the Geneva Conventions. And I think that the problem with the Civilian Complaint Review Board is that its parameters are too limited to take into consideration the various human rights issues that arise from the use of the chokehold. And then secondly, in addition to the lack of medical response, there's a real serious question here, especially in the context of civilians, whether the chokehold also would be violative of the Geneva Convention. So now you talk about a whole new level that really needs to be looked at, and is not being presented by certainly ambulance chasers, because this is beyond that whole sphere. To begin to invoke human rights and Geneva Conventions into the area.
Well, I mean, what we've been discussing so far I mean, it sounds so unrelated in a way to the strict matter, because people are being conditioned to believe that this is, you know, as long as the police department agrees to review this, and as long as there is justice, i.e. meaning that this case would result in compensatory and punitive damages at the civil level, and hopefully at the conviction of these police officers at the criminal level. But the record suggests that that is not likely going to be the case. The former would probably be that it would result in a hefty fine, a compensatory and punitive damages at that level, but not necessarily criminal convictions on the other level. So
go ahead.
No. So I'm saying that what we're pointing out here in the course of this discussion is the flip side of the coin, where people are thinking one way, but these kinds of cases really require a response that is very different from the traditional response that these cases have had.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct, and I just say this now. I won't necessarily dwell too much on it, but you know, this resembles the game of chess. The way that it is being played out. And so, one thing that I've decided to do is to hold a teach-in, which commemorates the Freedom Summer 1964, and to apply legal chess to the investigation of the death of Eric Garner. And so, you know, that's something that I hope people will be able to come out to. Because I think if you put it in the context of legal chess, that's what these people are doing, which is frustrating to most observers, because a lot of us, including myself, don't know how to play chess. So that's why, you know, I'll be bringing some experts in who do. But I do know enough about chess to know that these are chess moves that are being acted out. And in light of the fact that censorship is running amok in New York City, things are very, very dangerous at this particular time for the protection of our civil and human rights.
You've been involved in some of the most high-profile and contentious cases in New York City involving police misconduct and prosecutorial misconduct and judicial misconduct. In this case, what rings true to you as a recurring theme?
Well, the thing that bothers me particularly is my having a particular insight into the way that things are played out in Staten Island, where Eric Garner lost his life. And, you know, I've been involved in some very ticklish cases where the police department was also involved and the judicial system was involved. And I can absolutely tell you that anybody go to the Richmond County District Attorney's Office looking for justice is absolutely a person who should be seeking mental health, because that particular community is a community of uniformed services, meaning particularly the police department, the fire department, EMT, sanitation, all the other uniform services that in a case like this is putting considerable pressure on the district attorney of Richmond County to straighten up and fly right if he decided he was going to get a limp in his walk. So that is what is particularly disturbing, is the fact that you have a situation here where the governor of the state of New York is looking at this, it has responsibility, because what most people don't seem to understand is that the buck stops at his desk, meaning Andrew Cuomo's desk, and that he himself has the authority to remove the mayor of the city of New York from his office, or remove the police commissioner from his office, and instead appoint a special prosecutor. So you're sitting here now looking at over 1,000 chokeholds, and nobody's heard from you at all on this situation, and you seemingly should have enough judicial knowledge to know that nothing is getting ready to be played out in Staten Island, and that any acquittal, if the case goes that far, is only going to encourage more conduct of this type, especially when you consider that this is a case of stop, question, and frisk, and therefore the right of probable cause before the police department takes any action was totally wiped out. This was a case where at best they had reasonable suspicion, but no more than that, and reasonable suspicion really based upon prior conduct and not necessarily what Eric Garner may have been doing at the time that they took him down.
So the correct response by, say, people like Al Sharpton and others who stepped into this breach of leadership should have been to call for a special prosecutor in this case.
Well, that is absolutely correct. And I think people fail to understand. And, you know, to the extent that Reverend Sharpton needs to make a lot of money, that's his business. As long as his business doesn't step on my business, that's fine. My business is justice. So if he can run around and get hush money and entertain and be entertained by ambulance chasing, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But when it comes to defeating justice, you know, that I have a real problem with it because I spent over 40 years trying to pursue justice. So, you know, if he's a new kid on the block or a veteran, whatever the case might be, everything is fine as long as he's not trying to suffocate justice. When he started doing that, then I have a real concern for what he is doing. And in this particular case, it's very clear that Reverend Sharpton is a businessman and running a protection racket, and therefore he is a racketeer.
You're being a little harsher, wouldn't you say?
I mean, pardon?
You're being a little harsh, wouldn't you
say?
Well,
no, I'm just being accurate, you know. And I can just remind you that I have a perfect record in defamation cases, and I don't intend to lose it with Reverend Sharpton.
Well, in this regard, Andrew Cuomo has to look, he need not look too far. He could look at his own father and the history of the trouble that he has had with appointing a special prosecutor in cases. So it is not likely that he's going to go that route because this is risky business. When you get to the point of appointing a special prosecutor, it means, number one, to the local prosecutor, the message would be sent that I, the governor, don't have sufficient confidence in your ability to properly prosecute this case. So I will ask you to step aside and let this process go through, which will now, you know, to increase the confidence of people in the criminal justice system and to give the semblance of impartial justice here. You're correct about Staten Island is, and that part of Staten Island is known to be very much a community of law enforcement people who live on that island, Richmond County, and they have an inordinate influence on how things go in Staten Island. But could you recall in cases where you had demanded a special prosecutor, what was at the root of the resistance to appointing a special prosecutor?
Well, I think the root of resistance is across the board. I mean, you know, and that starts with not only white reactionaries, but black elected officials as well. And so now you're caught in a situation where you just have to have a daring and courageous lawyer, a crusader, who just bent on justice to try to lead that operation. Now, in lieu of that, the other alternative here is that this has become a grassroots struggle. Grassroots in the sense that whenever there are conditions that are deplorable to a people, you start the process by not financing your oppression. And that's rule one. And even the United States and other governments pursue the same rule. And therefore, if you were calling for sanctions and the people, let's say even on Staten Island, without getting into the rest of the four boroughs, decided that they were going to go after, for example, fast food joints, I can guarantee you if that struggle resembled what the struggle was in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955, that within weeks, the fast food operators would be pleading on behalf of the black and Latinos communities for justice. And this is really what you really want, because at that point, you know, when you invoke our refusal to finance our oppression into the equation, then I think you're going to get a very quick response, much quicker than any other kind of response that I could imagine. And I can tell you that McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and everything else, pizza joints and everybody else, would be up in Albany demanding that the governor take some action, because on balance, it is not at that point profitable to protect three or four rogue cops, some of whom have participated in this kind of conduct before, as opposed to protecting the property interests of those particular corporations.
Let's look at the obvious indicator here, and that is the element of race.
Mm-hmm.
I have not, there may have been other cases, but in my years of covering these kinds of cases, I have not yet come across a case where the chokehold was applied to anybody except an African-American or Latino. Certainly not in those cases that have become particularly contentious and well-known. And the officers involved in using the chokehold invariably were white. Here we have a repeat of the same scenario. What does that say about the state of affairs within law enforcement, the way the police officers are viewing the community, and the degree to which they think that these kinds of things could be gotten away with, even as it was being videotaped? I mean, it didn't deter the officer, Daniel Pantaleo, from refraining from applying the chokehold.
Yeah, well, you treat that two things. Two areas of evidence that are never discussed, and those are the two most pernicious areas in evidence law. And I'll preface that by saying that nobody ever came to a courtroom and saw me try a case, and I would invite people, and there were many people who've been in courtrooms and seen me try cases. None of those cases ever had a defense which required black witnesses, because that's the wrong thing that you could ever do. I've had only two cases of that kind, and neither one of them turned out well. So, you know, when you start talking about that, it doesn't help. Now, the reason why I bring that out is because the most two most pernicious areas of evidence law: reputation evidence and habit evidence. And reputation evidence really relates to the way that people perceive us, the stereotypes that we have, quote, earned, close quote, through slavery and the Constitution and supporting slavery and the slave codes backing that up under states' rights. Habit evidence, in which white people have a habit, and they've been trained like this over years, and this is the condition that they have, to expect that blacks will be always be docile. And so when they confront a black person, all of the laws on the book go out the window. And as I quote the Right Reverend Dr. William Augustus Jones, when he said that white people are rational on every subject except race. And that is so true, and it is true today, which means that all of the training that Bratton is now proclaiming to be done is going to have of no moment in improving the relationship between the police department and the black and Latino communities.
In this situation, as it is developing now, even as early as it is after this case, after the incident on July 17th, is it too early for an independent entity or an independent party to become involved by instituting a lawsuit that would force this discussion, but at a different level?
Well, I think that you have, you know, you're absolutely correct about that. And one of the flaws that we've had in our community is that, one, we don't even have a law firm in New York, a black law firm, that is, and we don't certainly have a public interest law firm. And so, you know, the stages of institutions that you have to have are lacking in the black community. They're not even discussed. I mean, nobody even talked about that. Several years ago, I founded the Mega Ever Center for Law and Social Justice. And, you know, obviously right after I found it, other people just jumped in and made sure that never happened. So you don't have the backup that you really need as a solo practitioner, and you certainly don't have the muscle that you need to initiate a RICO action, you know, where you're saying that the New York Police Department should be placed in receivership because it is incapable of conducting its own affairs, and that it is otherwise will continue to engage in racketeering, which is what it is doing now. So you don't have the resolve on behalf of attorneys, black attorneys particularly, to do that. And this is the reason why in the Central Park 7 case, there were only four black attorneys who showed up, and each one of those attorneys were disciplined. Three of them were barred from the courtroom forever, and the fourth one was suspended for a period of time to serve notice on others that you don't do this kind of work. And so, you know, that's why I'm so upset with the Central Park 7 case, and that's why I'll be in court to deal with that, because this is an absolute sellout, you know, that we are seeing even with them. And if these young men go through with this, they sustain this, they have learned nothing by being behind bars. They've learned nothing by being framed. And when you consider the fact of all of the good work that we all had to do aside from our legal participation in the case, but simply raising all the bail money and providing all the kinds of support for these young men, and for them to turn around and say, I'm going to take hush money, I mean, is a real indictment of them and what we can expect from our community. And I want to say this in regards to that. We are very much unaware of our own history. And, you know, we don't really know what these settlements, how they should be structured. And that's very unfortunate. But you see, a settlement has to be just before it is generous. It has to be just. That means that all of the elements of justice must be in the settlement before you even talk about compensation. So the compensation is later on down the road. But it's not what you immediately expect to get money. What you immediately expect is to correct the conditions. And so, you know, I use the example of Sarah Parker Remond, R-E-M-O-N-D, up in Massachusetts, This is some time ago, in the last two centuries, as a matter of fact. She was protesting conditions of segregation in Massachusetts, and a policeman came in and got in a scuffle with her and threw her down some stairs, and she was injured. And as a result of that injury, she brought a lawsuit. But the first thing that she did was not to accept the hush money or any compensation. The first thing she did was to force the proprietor of the movie house or the theater, wherever it was, to first make sure that that segregation was eliminated. And so the theater operator agreed to that, and then they started talking about money, and she got money also. So that's how you sell cases. If you're going to go that route, you first make sure that the conditions have been improved or eliminated that brought you there in the first place. And so, you know, when you start talking about Central Park 7, I have a list of 10 settlement terms that I intend to definitely make sure they happen before there is any settlement and before anybody receive any hush money. Otherwise, this is just a continuation of what Reverend Sharpton is doing, which amounts to a miscarriage of justice.
Well, you know, I have made the comment here, how many times do we go back around the same thing over and over again without changing the tactics? And this is why it is important to have a legal strategist, a legal tactician, to put the cases on course in such a way that, yes, people should be compensated, no question about that. But the larger picture here is to make sure that this never happens again. And here we are discussing yet another death of yet another African-American person by means of a chokehold, when this was supposed to have happened, stopped happening since the 1990s. And we know that how often it occurred even before then. So it means that this movement, and I, you know, I understand that in grief and so forth, people need help and they go where they can find it. And Reverend Sharpton is certainly a touchstone. At least he's perceived this way as a person who can get things done or get things moving or get resolution to difficult problems. But at the end, you have to separate all of the public relations and the television lights and all of that stuff from what is happening at ground level to structurally change things. And that is where you're not seeing any departure from the norm. You call in the big high-profile attorney who you know, he takes charge of the case, and the major point of the case now becomes situating the case for a big civil payoff. But beyond that, we will get the customary lines about, well, we will retrain the police force. As what do you need to retrain the police force for on a matter of chokeholds? Why do you need to retrain when you get, you know, this silly phrase of the broken windows practices, as Mayor de Blasio announced yesterday, that while they are proceeding with a thorough investigation of this case, the police department will continue its emphasis on quality of life type crime. So we're not seeing the structural response and changes, and that is because there is nobody forcing that kind of change to occur within the department. We see a lot of energy, a lot of attention being paid to forcing a hefty payout, but nothing in the way of structural reform.
Well, and you know, I think when you first started talking about that, you know, you talked about doing the same thing, you know, and using the same tactics. And I think that's a classic example of insanity when you are doing the same thing expecting a different result, even though you use the same strategy and tactics. And I think that's where we are. And I think we really have to just take a deep breath and stop and wait and listen to some voices of reason. And, you know, that's why the UAM Weekly Forum, and particularly this particular Wednesday night, you know, where I will be there with Sharp James, however, because his book is entitled Political Prisoners, and this is really where we are. I mean, we are basically political prisoners, and I think that discussion tomorrow night will be a prelude to us seeing how chess moves are being made, and that will happen on Saturday as it relates to Garner and what's the object and what moves are necessary in order to get this case off the board.
So let's see if we could review here. How do you classify the case right now? At what stage would you say the case is right now?
Well, at this particular situation, I think that this case is on, I'm looking for the word now. It's a medical term. This case is on a hospital bed, emergency room bed, looking for air. I mean, that's not really the term I wanted to use, but you know, people out there can get the understanding. It is really on its last leg, and it may collapse very soon. If there's not an infusion of new blood to try to save it, that's just how close it is. And I think that, you know, the best that we can do is at this particular stage, initially start with a teach-in, which we want to do on Wednesday night, and then another one on Saturday, and try to really come out of it, out of that teach-in swinging, and with some new life support systems that would allow us to sustain our struggle against this very odious act that took the death, took the life, rather, of Eric Garner.
And in that regard, who would be the primary targets if you come out of the box? If the community were to have reorganized itself and a tactician were really in charge of the legal thrust of this case, what would be who would be the likely targets?
Well, the premier target, because we're now talking about chess, the premier target would be those persons who have chosen to protect the king. And in this particular case, it would be Governor Andrew Cuomo, who had prosecutorial authority on a state level, and President Obama, who has prosecutorial authority on a federal level. And Reverend Sharpton is blocking both of those particular offices from getting involved, or in fact protected those offices from getting involved. So you really have to go straight out after them first, just to him first, to remove that so we can move on. And to do that, you know, you talk about a lot of formidable opponents. You talk about somebody who's going to be given millions of dollars to keep us confused. And so we have to get beyond the propaganda in order to make that next move. But this is where we are right now. I mean, basically right now, Reverend Sharpton is winning. This case is headed for the cold case file. And that's just really the situation. So we do have to move against him first, because this is a million-dollar operation for him. And, you know, and he's going to the bank grinning and laughing and just waiting for another dead body to pop up, and then the buzzers will come out again to feast. And, you know, and this just amounts to insanity. I mean, nobody can live like this when you don't know who's going to be next. I mean, that's not a good feeling, but yet that's the situation that we are here in New York City.
But your tactic, as you just defined it, people may say, well, you're creating further divisions in the community. Why not seek a rapprochement? Why not seek a way of working with Reverend Sharpton insofar as he occupies such a prominent space in the public eye? Why not his position to the benefit of the ultimate goal and tactic here?
Well, that's like encouraging the chicken to go to the fox for justice. it's one-sided. What would be the reason why Reverend Sharpton would cooperate with any of us when he's living at large and doing what the masters are paying him to do? I mean, he has no interest in seeking justice for black people and on any circumstances. And, he's the B.T. Barnum of this circus that we are caught up in right now. And he's not going to change. He has no reason to change. I mean, that's just the bottom line. If he had an iota of an incentive to change, he would. But he's not. And right now, he sees himself as having the full support of the reactionary community, and that's where he's going to lie. So no, there's no division in the black community. The question is, who will take money from Reverend Sharpton and who won't? That's the only division, because he got a lot of that, and unfortunately there are a lot of social parasites in our community, and they're going to be just like chickens jumping at chicken feet.
Well, I tell you, this case is very, very significant in that it could, if handled right, it could deliver justice all the way around, but it most definitely should deliver justice in the way that justice has been sought for so many years around this particular question and around police brutality issues generally, but in the matter of chokehold deaths and the abuse of authority by police officers and so forth, this case could serve as the watershed for a new way, a new reality in terms of the ability of the community to assert and affirm its power and authority over how the police are supposed to function within within the community.
No. Well, there's no question about it. And we got all those factors in our favor this year. This is Freedom Summer 2014. That means that in this particular year, there's a gubernatorial election. We are a large group. Even if Andrew Cuomo was able to squeak a win, he would still be damaged because of the fact that the man got other ambitions. I mean, he want to go back to where he came from, and that's Washington, D.C. And so, you can't go back to Washington if you only have a narrow victories in your home state. And so, and to our surprise, a lot of black people don't realize this, but we have the formidable strength to exercise considerable political leverage in this state, and we need to start doing that. And so, these opportunities are only going to knock so many times, and they ain't going to never knock again. So if we waiting for the next time may never come about.
Well, Alton, I want to thank you for this enlightening discussion because, I always tell folks, things are never what they seem. It looks like a case of, police brutality, but this is a hugely complex case that involves so many components to it. And as in the course of our discussion, I hope people got to appreciate the fact that there are so many aspects to this case that must be rectified in order for true justice to be delivered here.
Well, that's certainly true, Eutrice. And like I said, the road going to start tomorrow at the Brooklyn Christian Center, and it's going to be repeating itself on Saturday at the same venue. And I hope a lot of people turn out because we're not going to get that many more opportunities to correct these conditions in New York City.
Well, thank you, Alton, for being with us today.
Thank you, Eutrice, for the invitation.
Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope that it brought to light this other side that we seldom see or discuss when these cases occur. But this in fact, has been the discussion at a particular level within the community for all these years. In the 40-plus years that I've been covering these kinds of cases, this is the discussion that we have been having all the time. Why does it continue? And we hope that in the course of this discussion, that has been made clear. Some of those pieces have been put in place for you. Do let me know what you think about these programs. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here. Coming up next is Infectious Myth with David Crowe.